To Moist's amazement, Dick suddenly ripped out at him like a lion. He could almost hear the growl. "Who are you to talk, Mr. Moist? What have you made, built, fretted over? I see none of your fingernails are torn, and you can talk well in a fancy way, but what is it you've made? What is it you are?"
"Me, Dick? Well, now I come to look at it, I'm the grease that turns the wheels and changes minds and moves the world along. Or you might say that I'm a kind of a cook, but it is a special kind of cookery. It's a bit like the sliding rule. You just move things about at the right time and you get the answer you need. In short, Dick, I make things happen, and that includes your railway."
The young man swayed in front of him, and Moist's tone became gentle. "And I now see that part of my job is to tell you that you need some rest. You've run out of steam, Dick. Look, we're well on the way to Uberwald now, and while it's daylight, and we're out of the mountains, and it's going to be the least risky time to run with minimum crew, we're all going to need our wits about us when we get near the pass. Surely you can take some rest." Simnel blinked as if he'd not seen Moist the first time and said, "Yes, you're right." And Moist could hear the slurring in the young man's speech, caught him before he fell and dragged him into a sleeping compartment, put him to bed and noted that the engineer didn't so much fall asleep as somehow flow into it. And, that job done, he went to the guard's van where Vimes was drinking coffee and carefully going through the paperwork relating to the captive Delvers, who in the pinch sang like most canaries. "Commander Vimes, can you help me a moment?"
"Problem, Mr. Litvig.
The lads are working all the time and they seem to think it's the badge of a man never to go to sleep.
I have to teach that to young coppers. Treasure a night's rest, I always say. Take a nap whenever you can."
"Very good," said Moist. "Now, look at them here, still working on the sliding rules and fretting themselves because they've spent too much time trying to put one over on the universe."
"It seems like that," said Vimes, getting up.
Together they wandered along the train, forcing the engineers to at least lie down in their bunks or face the wrath of Sir Harry King. And in a few cases, Moist suggested of the Twilight the Darkness should dose them with one of his harmless little potions. Not all of them, of course, in case there was an emergency. You never knew when you might need an engineer. In his cell, Albrecht Albrechtsen had had plenty of time to consider Ardent's tactics. Ardent was a mere stripling youth. A dwarf is not thought of as a youth until he is in his 50s. But was already revealed as a manipulative chancer, seeking advancement come what may and by any means he deemed necessary. He wormed his way into everything, and in that sentence, Albrecht thought the important word was worm. Being Ardent's prisoner was galling. The food was good, and drink likewise, even if the small beer was smaller than he'd have liked. He was allowed some of his books, too, apart from those Ardent considered undwarfish, a terminology that told you everything about the arrogant young upstart, still wet behind the helmet, who was no doubt keen to get his paws on the whole of Schmalzberg, undwarfish fat mines and all. And in his little dungeon, Albrechtsen had to endure Ardent's self-serving philosophy about the role of the Low King. What insolence! Lecturing him, the foremost scholar on the subject. But it didn't do to get angry, at least not yet. Anger was a weapon to be honed and treasured and used only at the moment yielding most premium. And that thought was followed by a noise on the stone stairs as the pompous fool came again to get him to change his mind. Of course, Ardent would begin as if he was just an old friend coming to chew the rat, but as he talked, Albrechtsen would glimpse the coils of a decent mind unfolding. After all, he was opposing his sovereign, something not done lightly, if ever. Ardent had to be aware of the penalty for those who took up arms against the Low King. Despite everything, there must have been a good mind there, one which could have been useful to dwarf kind as a whole, and might yet be useful, even if, right now, it couldn't tell pyrites from gold. It was no secret that the most highly balanced minds, sometimes, well, overbalanced. The key turned in the lock. There was Ardent, and his expression seriously frightened his erstwhile mentor. You needed to be mature to sense this sort of thing, but you could tell in a person's eyes if they were being driven by an idea. They had a clammy look about them, and so did Ardent. Nevertheless, Albrechtsen laid down his pen and said in a calm voice, "So kind of you to come and see me. I understand the king'll be here shortly.
courtesy of the train. Won't that be nice?
There was a little bloom of spittle on one side of Arden's face, and he snapped, "You can't possibly know that."
Albrechtsen sat back convivially and said, "It's probably true that I taught you all you know, young dwarf, but I did not teach you all I know. I have some skills that I didn't impart."
"Then they must include guesswork. I hold the key to information in Schmalzberg. No Klax Towers are standing."
"Oh yes, so I hear."
"Rhys Reason is betraying all that is dwarfish. And for the sake of our species, you surely know that I must take the Scone of Stone. The majority of the dwarfs here are behind me."
Albrechtsen twiddled a pen in his fingers and said, "Possibly in order not to have to look at your face, Ardent. You're shaken, and the courage of your convictions will see you convicted the moment the king steps into Schmalzberg. From what I know of Rhys Reason, he may be merciful."
"Yes, I thought you'd say something like that, but the deed is done."
Albrechtsen looked stunned. "You've actually taken the Scone."
For a moment, Ardent looked foxed. "Not as such. Everything is in place. It only needs me to take the final step and Rhys Reason can have a retirement somewhere out of the way, like back in Chlamydos."
"Then do it now. Go on. There's nothing to stop you, is there? But the Low King is elected, isn't he? How certain are you? How certain are you that all your fellow travellers are stalwart? Because I'm absolutely certain that many of them are not. Oh, yes, they fawn on you and promise a lot. But as the train comes closer and we hear the whistle of change blowing, I think you'll find that suddenly they have other engagements and recall never talking to you about the Scone of Stone. That's happening now and you don't know it."
It was unfair, really. Ardent said, "I invite you to remember that you're locked in here and I have the only key."
"Yes, and of the two of us, you are the only one sweating. You'll be surprised at what I know. How many Klax Towers have come back out of the ground like mushrooms? And I know what the Ankh Morpork dwarfs are saying. You want to know? They say, why don't we have the Scone of Stone in Ankh Morpork? After all, there are more dwarfs in Ankh Morpork than there are in Schmalzberg.
You would countenance our Scone in that wretched place."
"Of course not. But neither will I see you on the Scone of Stone. Your Grags are losing their followers. Not just because of the Klax Towers, and not because of Ankh Morpork, but because new generations arise and think, what's all this about? How can our parents be so stupid? And you can't stop people any more than you could stop the train."
Albrechtsen was almost sorry for Ardent now. You could live in denial for a long time, but like a snake, it doubles back and strikes.
"You should face facts, Albrecht Albrechtsen. You'll be amazed at my support. Dwarfs must remain dwarfs, not simulacrums of humans. To follow Rhys Reason is to become Dukza, a half-dwarf, less than that even."
"No, it is your kind of thinking that makes dwarfs small, wrapped up in themselves, declaring that any tiny change in what is thought to be dwarf is somehow sacrilege. I can remember the days when even talking to a human was forbidden by idiots such as you. And now you have to understand it's not about the dwarfs or the humans or the trolls. It's about the people. And that's where the troublesome Lord Veterinari wins the game. In Ankh Morpork, you can be whoever you want to be. And sometimes people laugh and sometimes they clap. And mostly and beautifully, they don't really care. Do you understand this? Dwarfs have now seen liberty. And that's heady stuff."
Ardent almost spat and said,
"You say that when you're known to be one of the biggest traditionalists in all the mines. I still am. And most of our traditions were to keep us safe, just in the way that the Grags in their great heavy clothing exploded the fire damp so that we wouldn't be burned alive. The rules of the mine. They learned the hard way, and the traditions are there for a purpose. They work. But somehow, you and the others don't realise that outside the caverns the world is different. Oh, I keep the special days and knock twice on every door and follow all the tenets attack. And why? Because they bring us together, as did the Klax Towers, until your blessed Delvis started to burn them. Burning words dying in the sky, is that to be the legacy of the dwarfs?"
He stopped. Ardent had gone pale and seemed to be shivering. But then his eyes blazed, and he snarled,
"You won't be driven, Albrecht, and nor will I. train or no train. It'll never get here anyway. The world is not ready for locomotion.
He glared at Albrecht, who said,
Yes, of course it isn't. But what you don't understand is that the world wasn't ready for the clacks, but now it screams as they're burned down. And I believe that locomotion has not finished with us yet.
The response was the slamming of the door and the turning of the key. And now the fool had locked him in for the night, just where he wanted to be. There were guards, Albrecht knew, but like guards everywhere, they tended to slumber or go off somewhere to smoke a pipe during the longer hours of the night, and in any case, very few of them came near to this particular dungeon, since sensible guards didn't want to upset someone like Albrecht. Even if you thought you were on the right side, you never knew who the winner would be, and in those circumstances, smaller fry might be the ones to get fried. After a while, Albrecht picked up the little spoon with which he had eaten his meal, and there was the subtle scratching of rock dust which led to the appearance of a goblin, who grinned at him in the gloom.
Here you are, Squire. Here's Clax Flimsies, fresh from Command of Imes, and a bottle of oil for lamp. Oh, and toothpaste you asks for. I've been told to tell you that train is moving like no one business. Sure to be here on schedule.
It was a kind of therapy to hear of the inevitable approach of the famous Iron Girder day after day. The aroma of a goblin, Albrecht thought, seemed to be a metaphysical one. After the initial shock, you had to wonder if the goblin smell was somehow arriving inside your head as much as through your nostrils. It wasn't even all that bad. It had the savour of old sculleries and southernwood. He took the packages and scanned the flimsies with the speed of a dwarf who had learned to assimilate the written word quickly. And he spoke with interest to the young goblin, a caste he had hitherto dismissed as a waste of space at best and a nuisance otherwise. But they seemed to be more level-headed than most of his fellow dwarfs, especially that fool Ardent, and it was amazing how they could get about in the darkness of Schmalzberg and make use of every rat hole before making use of the rat. And this one waited patiently while Albrecht sorted out some flimsies of his own to go back to the locomotive. And then the old dwarf did something else that surprised him. He said,
"What's your name, young goblin? And may I beg your pardon for not inquiring earlier? Please forgive an old dwarf who hasn't kept up with the times."
The goblin looked stunned and said,
"Well, Gov, if it don't hurt anything, I am the Rattle of the Wheels. Railwaymen Friends is calling me Rat for short name. That makes all this very annoy."
Albrecht held out a hand. The Rattle of the Wheels stepped back and then came forward sheepishly.
"Nice to meet you, Rattle of the Wheels. Have you any family?" "Yes, your worship. My mother is of the happiness, the heart. Father is of the sky, the rim. And small brother is of the water, the crane."
And after a moment the goblin said,
"Actually, sir, you can stop holding my hand."
"Oh, yes. I suppose that my name should be Of the Moment, the Stupefied. Good luck to you and your family. You know, in a way, I'm jealous of you. And now I've finished my work for the day, I'd like you to take my paperwork, such as it is, and hide it somewhere around here where no dwarf is going to look."
"We cleans toilet, sir. Knows plenty many places that not visited. Same time tomorrow."
The handshake fulfilled, the goblin disappeared into a hole that even a rat might find difficult to get into. And as the sounds of the goblin scrabbling through the hole faded away, Albrecht thought, "I would never have done that before. What a fool I was." Mrs. Gwendolyn Avery of Schmarm awoke in the middle of the night to the shaking and rattle of the multiple bottles of age-defying unguents on her dresser. And then she realised that the whole house was shaking to a rhythmic thudding. When she described this episode in dramatic tones to her friend Daphne the following morning, she said that it was like the sound of a lot of men marching past. She put it down to the cherry brandy she had had before going to bed, whilst Daphne, knowing Gwendolyn's regrettable spinster status, put it down to wishful thinking. The Slake Ranges were half tundra, half desert, mostly windswept. In short, a fossil of a landscape where nothing generally grew but stumbleweed. Stumbleweed is like tumbleweed but less athletic. This tells you everything you need to know about Slake. And the occasional gregarious pine, the nuts of which were said to be an antidote to melancholy. There was water,
Oh, yes, but mostly underground, and prospectors and rockhounds were said to send down buckets to dredge water from the depths of the caves. It was slightly easier to find water on the uplands hubwards of the tundra, where there were icy streams courtesy of the Everwind Glacier, making it possible to raise goats there. And so goats were what young Nutt's family had bred and milked and minded down the centuries. And when the goats were eating what passed as grass on these highlands, he would sleep and dream of not chasing goats over a near barren landscape. He had liked it at first, but he was growing older, and something was telling him that there was a better life than watching goats eat their lunch. Once, twice, and sometimes thrice. Sometimes the faces they made were an entertainment, and sometimes he laughed. And yet a yearning in him told him that goats were not enough. And so it was, when the long sound echoed across the tundra, that he hurried to see what was making the wonderful noise and saw a shining streak snaking its way over the landscape in the early morning light, and it was heading his way. He wondered if it was anything to do with the strange bars of metal laid carefully on the tundra below by the gangs of men some weeks before. He had run errands for them and sold them his mother's cheese, but he couldn't really understand what it was they were doing, and since the goats stepped carefully over the metal strips without harm, he'd given up wondering. But as far as he could make out from what the men had said, it was all for a wondrous thing that could go around the world on a flash of steam. And now he wanted to know more about this singing beast, coming over the tundra, occasionally spitting fire. Nutt scrambled down off the hillside to where the air was warmer, leaving the goats, and ultimately traced the noise to a kind of big shed. And just as he got to it, the creature, carrying people inside it, broke out of the shed and hurtled away along the metal rails. He watched it until it had entirely disappeared. And later, some of the townspeople told him it was what they called a locomotive, and in his heart the yearning started and began by degrees to grow. Yes, there truly were other things than goats. Having spent a long afternoon and evening alert for anything untoward while Simnel and his lads lay dead to the world, Moist in his turn had slept soundly all night and now dozed right through the morning, rocked by the motion of the train as she steamed on from Slake across the valley of the Smarl, dreaming of the bridge over the gorge at the Willinus Pass. Never a picnic at any time, that was looming up fast like a tax demand. Anything could happen before they entered that dry land maelstrom of sliding rocks, falling rocks, and, well, rocks full of bandits of all disciplines. To coin a term that might fit the circumstances, it was like running a gauntlet with no shoes. A gauntlet full of rocks, and even pebbles had bad attitudes at that altitude. Moist winced at the thought of the place. The train hurtled on through the vast landscape. A huge amount of space, oh yes, but not many towns, just the occasional settlement. There was so much space everywhere, and Iron Girder ate it up like a tiger, attacking the horizon as if it were an affront, stopping only if it was known that water and coal were available. You could never have too much of either. By the middle of the day, the mountain ranges of Überwald were getting closer, and the air was getting colder, and Iron Girder's pace had settled to a steady climb through the foothills towards their destination. Lonely goat herds could be seen on the trackside, and amongst the people staring at this new mechanism, there was a definite outbreak of dirndls. In every township they passed, people were ready for them with flags and, above all, with bands that wheezed and umpired as the crowds cheered Iron Girder on her way. And yes, as the train came past slowly and carefully, you had to watch out for the little boys running after her, following the dream. It was a sight to yodel for. And now Moist noticed that Simnel was looking increasingly worried and took the opportunity of one of the engineer's rare breaks from the footplate to speak to him privately. "Dick, Iron Girder is the best locomotive you've ever built, right?" Simnel wiped his hands on a rag that had already seen too many greasy hands and said, "She surely is, Mr. Litvig. We all know that, but it's not Iron Girder I'm fretting about. It's that bridge over at Gorge. We've done everything we can, but we need more time. There's no way the bridge will hold with all the weight of the train and all." "Well now," said Moist, "you have the loggy sticks and the knowledge of the weights and the stresses, and all the other sliding rule business, and that's telling you one thing, but I'm telling you now that if the bridge is still not secure when we get there, I propose that Iron Girder will fly across the gorge with you and me on the footplate. You might call it a sleight of hand, even a trick, but we will fly." The engineer looked like a man who has been challenged to guess under which thimble the pea is, and knows deep in his boots that it will never, ever be the one he selects.
"Mr. Litvig, are you talking about magic here? I'm an engineer, I am. We don't all wear magic."
And suddenly Moist's voice was as smooth as treacle.
"Actually, Mr. Simnel, I think you're wrong in that. You believe in the sunshine, although you don't know how it does it. And since we're on or near the subject, have you ever wondered what the turtle stands on?"
Dick was cornered and said,
"Hey, well, that's different. That's just how things are meant to be."
"Pardon me, my friend, but you don't know that. Nevertheless, you go to bed at night quite happy in the belief that the world will still be there when you get up in the morning." Once again, Dick tried to get a grip on the proceedings, still wearing the look of a man certain that whichever thimble was going to be picked up, it wouldn't be his. A given in the scheme of things.
"So we're talking about wizards then, Mr. Litvig?"
"Well, magic," said Moist. "Everything is magic when you don't know what it is. Your sliding rule is a magic wand to most people, and I know some kinds of magic. And so I'll ask you, Dick, have I ever let you down in any way during our time on Harry King's business?"
"Oh, no, Mr. Litvig," said Simnel, almost affronted. "I see you as what my old granny called full of fizz."
Moist caught the fizz in the air and juggled it.
"There you are, Dick. I believe you when you say that the numbers on the sliding rule are telling you things. In return, I'd like some trust from you. No, please don't use your sliding rule for this. It's the wrong tool for the job.
I know something. Not exactly magic, but extremely solid. And with what I have in mind, by the time we get to the bridge, you'll think we're riding through the air."
Simnel once again looked as if he was about to cry. "But why won't you tell me?"
"I could," said Moist, "but Lord Vetinari would have me dead."
"Eh, we can't have that, Mr. Litvig," said Simnel, shocked.
Moist put an arm round Simnel and said, "Dick, you can perform miracles, but I propose to give the world a spectacle that'll be remembered for a very long time."
"Hey, up, Mr. Litvig, I'm just an engineer."
"Not just an engineer, Dick. The engineer." And, as Simnel cherished that thought, he smiled nervously and said,
"But how? There just isn't enough time, and there aren't enough men neither. Harry King has brought out all his heavy-duty workers in the city and the plains, so I don't know where you'll get more support from."
"Well," said Moist, "I'll have to be like Iron Girder. I'll just whistle." Simnel laughed nervously.
"Hey, Mr. Litvig, you're a sharp one."
"Good," said Moist, with a confidence he wasn't entirely feeling. "We should be ready by dusk." Just then Iron Girder let loose a little bit of steam, and Moist wondered if it was a good omen or possibly a bad one, but it seemed to him to be an omen anyway, and that was enough. That afternoon, in an attempt to distract his thoughts, Moist decided to tackle something that had been niggling at the back of his mind ever since they had left Stow Lat, and for that he needed to talk to Aaron. The King's secretary was slim for a dwarf, almost nimble and quick, and decidedly ubiquitous, his long beard following him like a banner as he went about on the King's business. He carried a sword, not traditionally a dwarf weapon, and had acquitted himself well during the attack on the train at the Paps of Scylla. Choosing his moment carefully, Moist waylaid Aaron in a place where they could talk privately.
"Mr. Secretary, I have to ask whether all is quite as it seems with the Low King."
Aaron's eyes narrowed, and his hand went to the hilt of his sword.
"Of course it is. What a ridiculous question. Treacherous, too."
Moist put his hand out placatingly. "Look, you know I'm on your side. I have to ask because of something I saw at Mrs. Simnel's house."
Aaron looked startled and said, "I believe the side you're on is your own, sir, and whatever you think you saw, it's certainly no business of yours."
"Indeed it is, my friend," Moist replied. "The gods, for my sins, gave me a nose for scenting when the metaphorical shit is about to hit the windmill, and I want to be prepared." Aaron stood frozen, and without looking directly at Moist, he said,
"Your perspicacity does you credit, Mr. Litvig. Your silence, even more."
"Oh, come on. There's something going on here, and I'm not in on it. Don't force me to draw my own conclusions. I do have a very big pencil." But Aaron clearly had nothing further to say. The appearance of a couple of engineers at the end of the carriage provided the excuse he needed for bringing the conversation to an abrupt close.
He turned on his heel and marched smartly off down the corridor, leaving Moist with every suspicious nerve in his body jangling.